Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Plutzcast. We've got a fabulous guest with us today. It's Sarah Eaton from Politico. Sarah, introduce yourself. Tell us what you do. Tell us about your interaction with lobbyists.
I spend a lot of time interacting with lobbyists now, and it's great fun. I'm a policy correspondent for Politico, and I write the EU Influence newsletter. It comes out once a week. It's a little bit of politics, a little bit of policy, a good chunk of gossip, and it's a great combination. So I actually rather enjoy spending time with you swamp dwellers and manipulators.
Lizard people, we prefer.
It's not the worst thing I've been called. So as a journalist who covers lobbyists, What's the difficulties for you? Do you find difficulties in gaining access to our world? Do you find that we are quite accommodating of your needs? Like, what's your impression?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason it's fun is by Brussels standards, lobbyists are actually much more accessible than the people they lobby in many cases. You all are talkative, you're charismatic, sometimes bullying, but I haven't experienced that too much. But yeah, I mean, probably lobbyists and political journalists aren't so different. We're trying to get information. We're trying to understand it. Obviously, you're then taking that information and trying to present it in a particular way. But yeah, both the lobbyists and the journalists are trying to get into the minds of the decision makers.
So trying to get into the minds of decision makers, but to what end as a journalist? So as lobbyists, we're trying to get into their minds to shape their views, to influence decisions, to influence their perspective of the business. But as a journalist, what's the objective of getting into the policymaker's mind?
Oh, to read it and to share everything in it. Yeah, I'm definitely not trying to convince them of anything other than they should talk to me, whether out of love or fear.
It's always a conversation that we have with journalists. There's on this competition to get the information. And we as lobbyists see it, getting that information, getting access from what the commission's doing, the leaked document, is always hard. And it always turns out the journalists got it first because the decision makers are trying to use the journalists to engage in that discussion and influence the conversation. Does that reflect on your experience? Do you think that journalists have an easier time getting hold of stuff from the institutions?
You know, I mean, sometimes we get it from lobbyists and often sort of a political truism that like the best way to sink a proposal is to leak it early. And of course, sometimes decision makers will leak something to kind of as a trial balloon to see how it goes. But yeah, I mean, everybody thinks the grass is greener on the other side. So I sort of feel like, you know, often it can be easier for lobbyists or other interested groups, whether, you know, NGOs, to get access to things. Because, I mean, the big difference is, like, I can't pretend that if you give me something that I'm going to keep it a secret. So that always adds an extra layer to getting information. So
Did you see the meme recently? It's like the fastest things on planet Earth. It's a cheetah. It's a jet plane. EU leaks into the Politico playbook.
Yes.
Which I quite enjoyed. But so how do you navigate this minefield then? Because all your sources of information are lobbyists or politicians. We all have agendas, and of course we do. But how do you retain your neutrality as a journalist?
I approach all of my sources with equal cynicism and assume that you're trying to use and manipulate me. But in all sincerity, like, just as it's your job to understand different motivations for decision makers, for your rivals, for your allies, it also, I'm better at my job if I understand different people's motivations. And so I understand who might be most likely to give me certain pieces of information. It's important for me to understand different motivations because I want to be neutral. If I'm writing sort of a broader article that's trying to present a policy issue or question, I need to know where, you know, how to make sure that I'm reflecting the full scope of the discussion. And that is actually, if I might, a big something that is harder about my job in Brussels than it was in Washington. So I've been at Politico Europe for 6 years. Prior to that, I was a reporter in Washington, D.C. and New York, including I was a White House reporter for U.S. Politico for a couple years. And in the U.S., I feel like there's a much more lively public debate, Whereas here, people really want to present a more dignified, collaborative front, even if there's more, verbal violence in the background or behind the scenes. But like in Washington, I sort of knew, okay, I got to call, like, I need to have a voice in order for this article to reflect the debate. I need to have a voice criticizing the White House from the left or from the right on this issue. And I knew who I could call, and that person knew that I was calling them for them to make a particular point, and they would make it to me, and they would make it to me on the record, and I didn't have to, you know, get quote approval and deal with their like wishy-washy statements. Whereas, yeah, here people are much more reticent. It can be hard to just kind of present a discussion.
Where do you think that reticence comes from? Do you think it's a cultural thing? Is it just that the Washington environment is just more sharp-elbowed? It's more, you know, politicized and polar, and here it's a bit more diplomatic and there's a more European sensibility to it?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I get the sense that people are afraid of angering people that they want to have access to. And so they don't want their voice in Politico, you know, giving them a hard time or criticizing. Whereas, I mean, and that calculation will certainly also take place in D.C., and there may be cases where people will use the press to suck up to, you know, a policymaker or something like that. But I think fear is a lot of it. And the other issue is people here, I think, are not as empowered to make their own decisions about what to say on behalf of the association that they're representing or the company that they're representing. So company, and I mean, it would probably be true also in Washington that like an in-house comms person or lobbyist for a company is probably not going to be making real aggressive comments in the media. But for a trade association or something like that, probably they would be much more able to be vocal. Whereas here, when I was a health reporter, for example, I would ask for a comment on some decision by the European Medicines Agency from some sort of patients group or something like that. And I knew what the people in charge of that patients group thought, but they would be like, it's going to take us days to react because we have to get approval for this very bland statement from our members. And I'm like, why are you hiring people, dear members of this patients group, like, why are you hiring people to be in Brussels to not say anything? Like, if you didn't think that they were smart about what they could say, what they would say, then you shouldn't have picked them.
I think that is a sort of that approvals thing has been a theme through a lot of the conversations we've had in this podcast. But, you know, Laura called it the chain of influence, not the chain of approval. So it's interesting to hear you as a journalist on the other side reflect that. But sort of talking about the way comms is done in this town as a journalist, do you feel that the trade associations and the company representatives are giving you the material you need in terms of the communication and what they're putting out there? Or is it, I'm almost picking up that some of the stuff you get is a bit too fluffy, a bit too vanilla.
Yeah, I mean, I think their attitude is that the press is not the place to air their grievances, or, you know, I mean, if they want to praise it, then they'll praise it to us, but it's not the place to complain. And that can make for quite bland journalism. In general, I'm proud to work for Politico Europe because we're often the only venue really in Brussels for some of these discussions to happen in a public way. But yeah, it's an enduring frustration that it's much harder to just get people. So, I mean, it's in some ways it's easier to get a leak than it is to get an authentic opinion.
Always a great position to be in. So our first guest, Sebastian Rodriguez, said as a kind of, he's talking about social media, and he said that Europe's 10 years behind the US. I'm an unashamed Ameriphile. Is that how you call it? I don't know. But I think also if you look at the public affairs sector, I mean, it's all connected, right? Mm-hmm. The social media, the media environment. I think developments in the US tend to be followed by Europe in a few years. Would do you concur with that? Do you see Europe, or these dynamics that are playing out in America start to filter down to Europe?
So I do think that there is a partial Americanization of European-level politics, partly because European-level politics are getting more political. So when the Fit for 55 package failed in plenary and everybody was sort of taken aback by that, I reached out to people who specialize in that file and asked if they think that this will just be a blip or if this is kind of a long-term trend that Parliament will be less predictable. And they mostly said they thought it would be a blip, but at the same time they said, look, like, we felt that the, like, this proposal was sort of half-baked, that the Commission wanted to make a point, and they put out this kind of bigger goal without really thinking about the details. And on the one hand, that can, I can understand why everybody who is used to a more kind of technocratic process is frustrated by that. You could also make the argument that, like, the commission was showing real political leadership, and they were like, we think that this is important, and we're gonna mandate that it happens, and then we'll figure out how to make it happen later. But that lends itself to a more political American style influence, process, and debate. On the other hand, there is a limit to how far it can go in terms of becoming like the US, because this will be a little controversial, but, like, there's sort of a democratic deficit at the European level, in that there are very few issues where you feel like sort of popular movements or popular understandings of things are actually driving it. In the US, you'll see campaigns, sometimes AstroTurf campaigns, but to create a perception that there's, like, a big citizen movement pushing for something. And that's why you see lobbyists using the political process. So you might say, okay, we need this senator to vote for this, and so we're gonna place an ad in their hometown newspaper, or I guess target Twitter users in their hometown for promoted tweets. And that will put pressure on that person because they'll feel like it could affect their reelection. Whereas here, like, how would you do that? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you don't have, I remember Boris Johnson had this quote, it was after Brexit had already happened, but he's like, you know, he's like, the problem with Brussels is, like, you don't know who the bums are and you don't know how to throw them out. And there's no threat really of, like, political consequences for policymakers' choices. And so that limits your ability to use American style campaign techniques.
That's fascinating. I hadn't really thought about it that way before, but I think you're right, because the way, and even you look at the way votes happen in the parliament, it's not a roll call vote always. It's just, you know, a sea of hands goes up and down, and you can't really hold anyone to account and follow them up or tell their voters, you know, they've put your investment in your region at risk because they voted the wrong way. But that's interesting to think about. Yeah.
But there is one industry that does this, only one, and it's fisheries. Because, you know, what is fisheries? It's like 0.2% of Europe's GDP. It's completely insignificant. Always punch above their weight. Like, if you want something done, speak to the fisheries guys, because they're the ones who get all the actual fishermen to speak to the local MP or MEPs, and they make it a huge issue in those constituencies. Mm-hmm. No other industry is as good as fisheries.
The farmers, you know, and if you talk about political action, you know, it's almost an annual tradition that there'll be a convoy of tractors through the centre of Brussels complaining mm-hmm. about some element of the cap or something. Mm-hmm. But you're right, those, you know, it's those industries that do the real political grassroots stuff. You know, the farmers is an example of real grassroots, but others just don't do it.
So perhaps let's explore that vein of EU versus US. So I'm pretty active on social media, but I get tarred the same brush, we get tarred the same brushes as US lobbyists. So people think that we kind of have this, well, they have this image of us as, like, shady guys, drinking whiskey, which we do, turn up with a bag of cash. We don't think of ourselves as that. But what do you think, looking at the lobbyists themselves, do you see more differences or more similarities, in fact, between US and EU lobbyists?
So I didn't cover lobbying directly in the US, is my caveat. But again, I think lobbying is sort of a different, it's definitely a different beast in the US, but it goes back to this thing where it's more partisan. So a lot of firms, you'll have the two principals of the firm will be a Democrat and a Republican, and they'll say, we can introduce you to people on either side, mm-hmm. whoever you need. The other factor that is really big in the US, and that I know is a subject of alarm for some watchdogs in Europe, is the revolving door. And in the US, there are a huge number of political appointments. So, I mean, we certainly have our deep state and our bureaucracy, but you also will just see these tidal waves rushing in and out, depending on, you know, which party is in the White House. And so you just will have a lot of people who, yeah, worked in the White House, worked in the cabinet departments, and then they'll be out of a job. This is a subject in Brussels also, but like all of the big law firms in DC are also lobbying shops. But yeah, so you have all these lawyers who are in and out of the administration. They already have a political orientation, definitely have an opinion, and they are using their expertise and their connections, but also just their sort of authentic ideological alignment with people who are making decisions.
You see it sometimes, don't you? Like, if you look at the Who Funds Who in America, which you can access, right? Well, you can see, like, most companies, they 98% goes to Republicans or Twitter, mm-hmm. right? Like, it was like 98% went to Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that money piece, I think, is one of the key differences. And, you know, mm-hmm. I've worked for American firms before, and they introduced the idea of the company had its own PAC, and employees were encouraged to donate to it. And I just thought, that's bizarre. That would never... The concept of money and lobbying never comes into it in Europe. And I think maybe some of the NGOs or some of the transparency organizations would like to make people think that's the case, but it's not. We would never do anything that looked like donating or financially supporting a politician.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in jail.
You go to jail, basically. Whereas in the States, it's like, oh, yeah, we're donating this money to these parties and this money to that, and it's just perfectly normal. It's almost like that's how you get access, is through your donations. Whereas here, it's just it's completely anathema.
Yeah. But again, they're using the electoral process. Like, you know, I didn't cover lobbying in DC, but, and we've certainly had some bribery scandals that led to some reforms. But if you're bribing the politician, you're doing it by helping his or her reelection or threatening, you know, holding it over their head like an axe over their head to say, well, we'll run advertisements in your district to get you in trouble. So yeah, people are using money as a tool, as a campaign tool. Mm.
Did it really, though, would you find lobbyists in America saying, do what we want or else?
If you did that in this environment, you'd be kicked out of the room, and you'd never have another meeting again.
We mention it all the time, the tech industry here, they try real brute force methods. And I worked for a while on the copyright directive, and I remember they flooded the entire parliament with emails. I had 365,000 under, like, junk emails, and they crashed the server. You're not going to get any influence in that. Like, it's going to alienate people. So it's weird for me to hear a fully stick method rather than a fully carrot method.
Yeah, I mean, I have found that really interesting that, you know, campaigns that I think are sort of clever and that, like, probably would work in the... Like, it's a classic thing for, you know, an interest group to have form letters and to get constituents of a particular politician to all mail in the same letter to the politician. And it's obvious what's happening, that, you know, but that works because this company or interest or whatever, like, showed that they could get these people to print out these letters and mail them in. And if they can get them to do that, they can also get them to vote. But yeah, those types of techniques seem to backfire here. But again, like, it's because it's annoying as opposed to actually threatening, because you can't throw the bums out.
Yeah. So. But that, yeah, and I think in the States you can throw the bums out, so there is that ability to be coercive is there. Here it's not, so we're forced now to rely on the force of argument and the evidence and the strength of the case that we're making, which is maybe more challenging, but I think it's a better way of doing things. But I wonder, is that US more coercive style, does it work or is it effective because politicians in the States, and maybe to an extent in the UK as well, they're almost lower on the pecking order. There's less sort of gravitas. Whereas here, politicians, whether it's, you know, somebody senior at the commission or an MEP, they're sort of seen to have a bit more social status. So you're almost coming to them as a supplicant. And there's something, you know, deeply about the European culture. You know, so American culture is more informal. Your leaders are there to have brickbats thrown at them. Whereas here, no, oh, you've got elected as an MEP. That must mean you're very important. I should kowtow to you.
Yeah, and
do
I mean,
you see that
yeah, I mean, yeah. Of course, like, the worst thing for an American politician is to be seen as too elite. One thing that's talked about as a cause of sort of the polarization in the U.S. is, well, the polarization among members of Congress and their increasing inability and lack of interest in compromising, is that they now go home to their home district every weekend. Instead of, and basically, you know, 4 days, Washington empties out of congressmen the way Brussels empties out on the weekend. And so they used to all kind of hang out in Washington and actually have to be friends with each other. And now they just always go back home to their districts. And so on the one hand, we'd say, like, that's great. They're in touch with the people that they represent. They'll continue to understand what their problems are and that sort of thing. But yeah, it means that they don't talk to each other. And so they don't like each other and they don't want to compromise. But yeah, in general, the U.S. definitely less formal. We call our Capitol building, you know, a temple of democracy. Anybody really can walk in. But I mean, my question for you, though, Patrick, would be like, have you lobbied at the UK level? Like, are we, you know, because I'm talking about like U.S. lobbying in national politics versus lobbying at a European level. But I mean, do you have these same dynamics in the UK?
Yeah, I think, but the UK level is, and the way it works is closer to the Brussels side of things. So yeah, you're engaging with MPs, but the access to the MPs is more about what can we bring to your constituency? How are we support? So it's almost, we're doing this in your constituency. This is the value we add. So please, can we come and talk to you? But you would never, you know, never imagine sitting down with one of my UK MPs and saying, vote this way, otherwise I'm going to fund your Labour opposition. That just wouldn't even come into my mind. Maybe I should start doing that and see how it works. But I think UK politics is becoming more Americanized, but I think not in terms of public affairs and lobbying. It's still much more about bring the argument, show the evidence, convince and persuade. So our watchword is educate, inform, persuade, rather than coerce. But that's from our point of view. I'm sure there are other companies out there that do things in a bit more of a... I think some of the bigger companies that have very close connections to government maybe are a bit more front foot on how they do things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you, Sarah, you rub your hands together when you hear the story about a lobby firm saying, do this or else.
If I did hear about that, I would definitely, yeah.
Do you have any stories? Do you have any, anonymized, of course, examples of really, really bad things lobbyists have done?
Again, I've only been in this role since May, so I'm still learning about... I am enjoying seeing the ways that... Enjoying in a journalistic sense, which means like enjoying, like, yeah, rubbing my hands together and like that thing. So yeah, I do absorb a lot of people being like, ugh, you know, like you barbarian Americans, like we're so much more civilized here. We're, you know, there's so much less money involved and blah, blah, blah. But like Europe does have some structures to create transparency, but like they completely don't work at all. And so just learning about the different ways that, for example, like sanctioned Russian companies or officials are finding ways to get access to the system. And that can happen from former politicians who, you know, are allowed to walk in the door kind of with whoever they want and wielding their existing relationships. So, you know, and the other thing that I find remarkable is that like the U.S. has this thing called, it's got its name in like the 1920s, but the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And if you're representing, doing a PR campaign or a lobbying campaign for foreign government, you have to register. And it's not even like the transparency register where you just kind of like put in some data. Like you have to actually like, people will submit like whole kind of proposals and detailed explanations of what they're doing. And if it's like a big agency, often I found that I learn more about what's happening in Europe from this US registration thing than from European systems. So I know that's not quite answering your question. You know, when I do have something, I will definitely write about it in Politico at the EU Influence newsletter.
So someone's got a scent of a new, was it Azerbaijani laundromat, the most recent big one?
Yeah.
Okay, so how would you, if you were to advise the commission, how do you make things more transparent? Because you're absolutely right, and some mechanisms don't work, and a lot of transparency is done off our own backs. So how would you advise the commission to kind of shore up lobbying here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the transparency register ideally would be more like there would be fewer exemptions. And I think it would be helpful if politicians were reporting who they're meeting with. And it needs to be in a format that is like more easily searched. Several examples of what I'm talking about. Like I was trying to see which agencies in town were working for Twitter. I put Twitter into the Transparency Register search, and there's no way to sort of like narrow your search. And so since every company lists their Twitter profile, like in in their listing, like I got literally every, I mean, fortunately, like the company Twitter was the first result that came up, but then I wanted to see which agencies listed Twitter as a client, and I couldn't do that. So just really basic like search refinement would be good. But the other issue is that even some politicians who say that they're dedicated to transparency are doing things to undermine it. So the folks at Transparency International pointed out to me that many committee chairs like hadn't reported any meetings in the official system since like 2020, including like Pascal Canfin, the chair of the Envy committee. And so I reached out to all of them and they're like, oh, well, you know, they post all their meetings on Twitter and on their website. And I'm like, that doesn't work. If, you know, if I have to know for all of the MEPs and where their bespoke approach to transparency is, like, it doesn't do any good. So.
And by the way, no, they don't, because we've met with Pascal Canfin and he didn't post it on his Twitter.
Well, he may be put on his own website. But yeah, no, I mean, that's, yeah. Like, and some of these MEPs were like, I'm offended that you are accusing me of like, blah, blah. And I'm just like, if you don't put it where I can find it. And this is like the EU and the institutions in general, like, it's true that the documents are there usually somewhere, but you have to know where to find it. And I actually feel like this has been a big service of a lot of lobbying firms, is to have junior people who are like looking at these websites every day to see if they've been updated, and they know where to find all the stuff. And, you know, I hope when they start improving the way they make that information available, you know, it will sadly put some junior lobbyists out of business. But I mean, it's just, you shouldn't need to hire lobbyists to like get access to basic public documents. You shouldn't have to have a very expensive Politico Pro subscription to get access to that stuff. But I mean, hey, like, it's good for our business model too, so we won't complain too much.
Let's not put ourselves out of jobs. So just to wrap up, bit of fun, what are your biggest pet peeves about interacting with people as a journalist?
So when people, I know this is like going to sound really petty, but when people ask me who covers what at Politico, you know, I want to pitch a press release on this topic, like who covers forestry. And I'm like, read Politico, like Google it. Like if you care enough about this issue that you want to pitch it, read our coverage, or at least pretend that you read our coverage. I, for some reason, it just like really, really bothers me. And I know that I should take advantage of like easy ways to do a favor for people, but no, I just get really angry.
There we go. Top tip, Google your contacts at Politico.
One other thing, and this actually, I really genuinely want people to understand this. So everywhere has different media cultures. And one of the challenges of reporting in the bubble with people from lots of different places is everybody's making different assumptions about how a conversation with a journalist starts. So in the US, everybody knows that it's assumed that we're on the record unless we say otherwise. Whereas here, I generally know that people assume that we're off the record unless we say otherwise. So always have good media hygiene and never hesitate to clarify with a reporter before the conversation starts. We are never going to be offended, and we don't like putting people in a position where they feel like they've been tricked into saying something to us. Like, that's not our goal. And I now start every interview with kind of a new person where I say, is it okay if I assume that we're talking on the record? And they'll say yes. And 9 times out of 10, when the conversation ends, they'll say, okay, so you're going to send my quotes before you use them? No, I'm not. That's what on the record means. And if you wanted to ask that question, you should have asked it at the beginning of the conversation. So thank you for letting me air my grievances here.
Just so you know, this is on the record.
What?
Great. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Do you have anything you want to plug? The Influence newsletter. You've got to talk about it.
Yes. It's a weekly newsletter. If you're a Politico subscriber, pro subscriber, then it comes out on Wednesdays, and a different version with possibly fewer typos, or it's the same version with possibly fewer typos, goes out on Thursdays for free. Yeah, I try to address issues that the sector is facing. I like to think of it as a mirror. So, you know, if there's not so good stuff, I'm going to talk about it, but I also don't need to punch you guys in the face all the time. If there's something interesting or good that is happening, I am just sort of I'm a longtime politics geek, and I'm also like a strategy and communications geek as well. So as you can probably hear from this conversation,
we all are.
It's a little bit of substance, a good bit of gossip. You can go to politico.eu/EU influence to subscribe.